The reign of God's love. This is a missionary church. So what's it mean? Number 269 of the exhortation. Committed to building a new world. We do so not from a sense of obligation. Now that's a beautiful thing. Obligation, by the way, Sunday obligation is a great word. Take you back to your Latin, which you people are closer to than I am, but ligare in Latin is the first declension verb meaning to bind. Like the muscle is bound to the bone by a ligament. Ligare. Ob in Latin means right up against, like obstruction, you know. Like. So an obligation is a bond that's real close. And that's what Sunday Mass is, the community. It's a bond that's real close. If you were playing tennis and you were the fourth person, you wouldn't roll over in bed and think, oh, I can't be bothered, it's too early, and leave the other three waiting at the tennis court. My God, you'd lose your friends pretty quickly because you've got an obligation to be there. You've said you'd be there and there's four people and they need you. Of course. So what are people doing rolling over and not coming to Mass? When the community needs their gift, needs their presence. We all need it. We need the teenagers there, we need the little kids there, we need the grandparents there, we need everybody there. And everybody needs each other. We're obliged to be there. Our problem was, we told people some time ago, I did, and I guess, we told them it was a mortal sin if they didn't come. Well, that's when the church really got sinful. Because what the church is doing then is using fear to get conformity. When it should be attracting, and we should be thinking, if people aren't coming, what's going wrong? Maybe the music isn't good enough. Maybe we're not welcoming enough. Maybe when they don't come, we don't even notice they didn't come and don't ring them up and say, how are you? Who knows? But we've got to, but it's an invitation to come. Back to number 269. We don't preach out of a sense of obligation. As I said, it's a beautiful thing, though. Not as a burdensome duty, but as the result of a personal decision which brings us joy and gives meaning to our lives. That's why we do it. That's why the teachers do it. That's why the catechists do it. That's why the grandparents do it. That's why we're all doing it. Now, as you know, that's a painting of Jesus being baptized, obviously. There's only one king in the Christian religion, and this whole talk will be about kingship, reigning, bringing about the reign of God, the kingdom of God. There's only one king in a Christian religion, and that's Christ. It's he who brings about the reign of God's love in our world. He does it. Now he, the vine, acts through the branches. So in baptism, did one on Sunday, and you probably did one too, the little girl that was is anointed king. Boy or girl, king. You haven't got Jesus and the little girl, two kings in the church, no. But because the life of Jesus is poured into this beautiful little baby girl, she is sharing in his bringing about the reign of God in the home, which she runs because she's a baby. And as you all know, the babies run the house. So, and she'll learn to love and bring about the reign of God in her unique way, as we all do. So we're all baptized king. Jesus' kingship. Number 22 of the exhortation. The gospel speaks of a seed which once sown grows by itself even when the farmer's asleep. It's a great parable. In fact, it's such a shocking parable that no one takes it. It's in Mark. And there's only about two scenes in Mark that are only in Mark. And this is one of them. I think Matthew looked at it and thought, oh, well, it's a bit over the top. You know, this farmer's just doing their nothing and then it all grows. And he says, great, this is great, and reaps it. So it could lead you to quietism or something. So, but there it is. The church has to accept this unruly freedom. What a good blooming statement from the Pope. Unruly freedom. You get a bunch of Scalabrinians together and there's unruly freedom all through the room. At least that's what it's like with MSC, so I presume it's the same with you. Good, good. This unruly freedom of the world, of the word, which accomplishes what it wills in ways that surpass our calculation and ways of thinking. And we can't control it, and we shouldn't control it, because God doesn't control it. Hence the terrible diseases in our world, I mean moral diseases, hence the cruelty, hence war, hence ISIS, hence all of that, but hence all the saints. Take freedom out and you've got nothing. You've got nothing. Number 24. An evangelizing community is always concerned with fruit because the Lord wants her to be fruitful. It cares for the grain and doesn't grow impatient at the weed. It's lovely, but it's simple. It's gospel. The apostles do what we're tempted to do if you're the parish priest or assistant or whatever the heck you are or I am. We're tempted to think, oh, there are weeds there. Let's dig them out. And the apostles go up to Jesus and say, look, there's all kinds of weeds. You want us to pull them out? Jesus says, no fear. You're too stupid to know what the weeds are and what the wheat is. He didn't say that, but, you know, that's the point. You haven't got the wisdom to work it out. And who knows? Sometimes the weed in you, someone gave me a, oh, you did, didn't you? But what is it, what's the phrase about weeds, they never die?
Erba cattiva non muore mai.
That's it. Erba cattiva non muore mai. So, but maybe the weed that's in you, that your novice master tried to get rid of, is your strength, is your virtue, is your courage, is you. If we're not careful, everything needs training and loving into life, but we're not into blobs, we're into people. Well, that was me, and now back to the Pope. Well, you've got it there now. The parish is a community of communities, a sanctuary where the thirsty come to drink in the midst of their journey, and a centre of constant missionary outreach. Is your parish like that? Is my parish like that? Here, little parish that it is, but it's a good question. Is it about missionary outreach or about maintenance till next Sunday? Number 88. True faith in the incarnate Son of God is inseparable from self-giving, says the Pope, from membership in the community. We're not individuals, we're persons, modern word, persons. And a person is someone in relationship. We started in relationship to our mother, then we learned about dad. We've always been in relationships. If I'm not in a relationship, I'm not a person. I'm an individual, existent thing, but I'm only a person when I'm communicating, communion. Like Jesus did with his Abba. It's inseparable, this faith in the incarnate Son of God. It's inseparable from self-giving, from membership in the community, from service, and from reconciliation with others. The Son of God became flesh. By becoming flesh, summoned us, lovely phrase, to a revolution of tenderness. Ask your parish, you needn't ask them, but imagine, ask the people in your parish, do you find Father tender? The answer should be yes. But the answer should be yes. He's such a tender man. We're finding the Pope tender. I am. I think you are. And many of them have been. But many of them have probably been a tender inside, but outside they were caught in the institutional. Well, I'm not here to judge any of them, but or whatever. But he seems to give us the ability. It's okay to be you. It's okay to be whatever your name is. It's okay to be Michele. Now we've got to purify it. We've got to do all that. And there's a lot of work involved, a lot of honesty involved. But it's okay to be me. George, which is his name, Jorge, or whatever he calls himself in his language, George is happy to be George, even when he's Pope. And that's very encouraging. And the whole world's picked it up. They picked up that we're not being told or spoken down to or controlled. He's saying, just be yourself, but be it beautifully, tenderly. Today, number 89, our challenge is not so much atheism as the need to respond adequately to many people's thirst for God, lest they try to satisfy it with alienating solutions or with a disembodied Jesus who demands nothing of us with regard to others. That can be the problem with some of these sects that are roaming around the world. They're not too good with the dying, they're not too good with suffering, and they're maybe not too good with the demands of poverty and care and smelling the sheep. They're a bit young yet, maybe they'll grow. Unless these people find in the church a spirituality which can offer healing and liberation and fill them with life and peace, while at the same time summoning them to fraternal communion and missionary fruitfulness, they'll end up being taken in by solutions which neither make life truly human nor give glory to God. Continuing the Pope's words, an authentic faith which is never comfortable or completely personal always involves a deep desire to change the world. Obviously, your founder must have had this immensely deeply. A deep desire to change the world, to transmit values, to leave this earth somehow better than we found it. We love this magnificent planet on which God has put us, and we love the human family which dwells here with all its tragedies and struggles, its hopes and aspirations, its strengths and weaknesses. The earth is our common home, and all of us are brothers and sisters. Indeed, and here he quotes Benedict here, which he loves to do, and is wise and also genuine, I'm sure. If indeed the just ordering of society and of the state is a central responsibility of politics, the church, again quoting Benedict, cannot and mustn't remain on the sidelines in the fight for justice. When it's said we're not supposed to be political, it means I'm not supposed to be getting up in the pulpit and saying vote Labour, and for God's sake don't vote for the coalition. I can't do that. Of course I can't. But everything we do is political, and we can get up and denounce injustice in our own lives and in the people's lives and in the world's lives, and we can name it. We're supposed to, but not on one side of politics rather than the other. In chapter 4, which the Pope talks about the social dimension of evangelization, bringing about the reign of God in the world, in other words, Pope Francis selects two critical issues. You know, this one is the inclusion of the poor, and the other is about peace and social dialogue. I'll be very brief on this. The inclusion of the poor in society, he writes, life for all must have priority over the appropriation of goods by a few. And as you people know better than I, some of you are working in this field all the time, in Australia, tragically, from when I was a young priest, 50-some-odd years I've been a priest, it's getting worse and worse and worse. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer in our country. Who creates the systems that make it possible? The rich. He prays for politicians, you can read it for yourself, and he quotes Benedict, today and always the poor are the privileged recipients of the gospel. When Pope Francis was elected Pope, I'd have forgotten the man's name, you may remember.
Hume.
Sitting next to him.
Hume.
Hume?
No, Cardinal Hume.
He was. He wasn't the English.
Brazilian.
Oh, okay. He said, "Don't forget the poor." Yes. That's the one. Well, he hasn't, and he's asking us not to show. God shows the poor his first mercy. Number 198. The church has made an option for the poor, which is understood as, quote, a special form of primacy in the exercise of Christian charity to which the whole tradition of the church bears witness. This is why, he says, the Pope, I want a church which is poor and for the poor. They have much to teach us. We need to let ourselves be evangelized by them. Abbé Pierre, after the Second World War, I don't know if he's still alive or not, but I don't think he would be, but he may be. He did a lot of work in Paris, you know, after the war, setting up things for people without work and all that. And he's got this incredible statement, which I kind of, it haunts me, because I don't do it. But I always think, he's onto something here, and this is what he writes. Let us never lose our living conviction that it's not necessary to wait until we're splendid people before we can do splendid things. That would probably mean waiting a long time, too long, in fact. We need only to understand one splendid thing and then try to base our whole life upon it. And that thing is that the person we must help in all things is the person who is suffering the most. Whew. That's really so clear, idealistic but clear. Well, there. But I think we'd all agree that it sounds right, but person we must help in all things is the person suffering the most. Now, you've got to discern that, of course. Here's Albert Nolan, the Dominican South African, who wrote that book, Jesus Before Christianity, which I don't think is such a very good book, really. But anyhow, he did write that, and he's written another couple since, more recently. But he says this: the option for the poor is an uncompromising and unequivocal taking sides in a situation of structural conflict. It's not a matter of preaching to some people rather than others, or a matter of being generous to the underprivileged, or a judgment about the personal guilt of the rich, or even, in the first instance, a matter of lifestyle. It's the assertion that the Christian faith entails, for everyone and as part of its essence, the taking of sides in the structural conflict between the oppressor and the oppressed. In too many countries, I'm not going to name them, that'd be silly, but because I don't know enough to do that, but in too many countries, the church for too long was on the side of the oppressor, for its own protection and comfort and all that. And we're not allowed to do that. He continues, a thoroughgoing option for the poor includes the willingness to question one's assumptions and to learn from those who are oppressed. It's only after one has learned to have confidence in the ability of the oppressed to promote their own cause and to bring about their own liberation that one can begin to share that struggle with them and to make a contribution in real solidarity with all those who've taken an option against oppression. I had two of my elder brothers who were MSC priests. I think we had the record. There were three of us in the orders. Two have died now, including this one. But he worked with the Aboriginal missions most of his life, and I learned something from him, but Australia hasn't done a good job there. I think you'd all agree we haven't. And we're still struggling with it. And I've got no answers, but they have to solve it. But we put them in such a dreadful place that they almost haven't got the means to solve it, because we've taken those means away. So an embarrassment for an Australian. Here's Pope John Paul II writing in one of his encyclicals. One of the characteristic themes and guidelines dealt with by the Magisterium in recent years, he's writing in 1987, so, is the option of or love of preference for the poor. This is an option or a special form of primacy in the exercise of Christian charity to which the whole tradition of the Church bears witness. It cannot but embrace the immense multitudes of the hungry, needy, homeless, those without medical care, and above all those without hope of a better future. It's impossible not to take account of the existence of these realities. To ignore them would mean becoming like the rich man who pretended not to know the beggar Lazarus lying at his gate. And in that dreadful parable of Jesus, the rich man did nothing to hurt Lazarus. He didn't put him there, he didn't make him there, he didn't starve him, he didn't do anything, he just walked past him, ignored him, and there he was. Again, John Paul II in another encyclical, the preferential option for the poor is not limited to material poverty. It's well known that there are many other forms of poverty, especially in the modern society, not only economic but cultural and spiritual. And I imagine you'd agree with me, the greatest poverty in our world is to lack love. Because in some countries that you've been in more than me, there's immense economic poverty and there's a lot of laughter and a lot of cuddling and a lot of loving going on that we in Australia, stuck in our little houses, don't know. And some of the richest people in the world must be terribly poor to need all that to give meaning to their lives, when what we need is love. And if they lack love, we mustn't pick on them for their wealth. We must love them so that they come to see, I don't need all this. And they do what many wealthy people are doing in some parts of the world. They give a lot of it away because they found they don't need it because they're loved. Here's Jean Vanier, lovely saintly man, thank God he's still alive. Indeed, far from being desirable, he says, success, power and wealth prevent us from being truly ourselves. It's only when we recognize our weakness, our poverty, when we seek help, that we can become human. We're not called to be perfect, we're called to be humble. And the word, as you know, comes from the word humus, stuff, soil. This is the gift we receive when we live with and work beside people who are fragile. The poorest lead us into another world. And then he goes on writing, since our Pope became Pope, and maybe we're guilty of this, check it, there's a lot of people clapping Francis. But are they doing what he suggests? Are they going to the peripheries and befriending the poorest and receiving the wisdom that the poor can give? The Church won't change because of Francis. It will change because of all of us. Because of me. Me meaning me. That's written in the Tablet of April this year.